Hello and welcome to the Scriptures Are Real podcast. I'm your host, Carrie Muhlstein, and I am so excited about this week's episode. I'm also so excited about what is coming up just this month in general and the beginning of next month because we are entering Easter season. And I have been so in love with making it a real season where we are focusing on Christ and what we can learn about Christ and celebrating Christ and being grateful for Christ during this Easter season. We're going to, in next week's episode, highlight elements of Joseph being a symbol or a type of Christ. We're going to highlight that in as we go through the Exodus story as well. We're going to have, during Holy Week, we're going to have special episodes each day where we help you to come to appreciate Easter and that Holy Week and what you can do each day of the Holy Week and how you can celebrate and worship Christ. And as part of that, I actually wanted to let you know about an opportunity, a couple of opportunities. One, there's going to be a Palm Sunday walk. My wife and I put this on every year. So I'll give you more details about that towards the end of the podcast or maybe partway through, but be ready for that Palm Sunday walk. But another one is a series of performances that are being put on by my friend Jenny Oakes Baker. And many of you have heard of Jenny Oakes Baker. She is often called America's violinist. I'll let her tell more of her own story, but she is someone who, like Joseph, is consecrated, and Joseph of Egypt I'm talking about. And when things she had choices to make, she chose to follow God and to use all of her talents and abilities to bring people to God. And so she does remind me of Joseph of Egypt in that way. Part of that is that she does these shows that help us come to Christ. And she's doing a special Easter shows of a fantastic, fantastic production called The Redeemer. So I'm just going to read this a little bit to you. She's a Grammy-nominated violinist, Jenny Oakes Baker, Emmy Award-winning composer and conductor Kurt Bester, acclaimed narrator and tenor Dallin Vale Bayless is also a dear friend of mine. Used to live in my stake before he went out to Southern Virginia University. Fantastic person. Tony Award-winning soprano Lisa Hopkins, Sieg Miller, baritone soloist Preston Kevin Yates, and cellist Sarah Baker Soros or Nicole Pinnell. So it depends on which performance you'll get. Joined to present this glorious multimedia musical journey, audiences will be thrilled and inspired by beloved hymns, soul-filling original compositions, and magnificent sections from Handel's Messiah. So this is, it's really a fantastic show. I've seen much of it. I'm going to see all of it this time, but I've seen much of it in various settings. It makes me think about Christ, brings me to Christ in fantastic ways. She's having shows March 14th, March 16th, March 14th in Las Vegas, March 16th in Ephraim, Utah, March 30th in Salt Lake City, Utah, April 2nd in Nampa, Idaho, a place that's near and dear to my wife's heart. She grew up near there, April 6th through 7th in Cedar City. So all you have to do is go to JennyOakesBaker.com. That's JennyOakesBaker.com for tickets. For those of you who are in this area, you can really enjoy this as part of your Holy Week celebration, as part of this Easter season. And then don't forget that we're going to be helping you with this Easter season. We've got all sorts of things on websites, and we'll be doing special podcasts, as I said, and so on. But let's talk about this week. This week, we're doing the Joseph story. I love the Joseph story. I'm so excited about the Joseph story. You're going to be able to join me as I walk around in Egypt, showing you some of the fertile areas there near what is called the Bar Yusuf or the Joseph Canal. And I'll talk about that while I'm in Egypt. There is a segment with my wife as we walk along next to the Nile where we explore the Joseph story. And then I have a special part of the podcast where we talk about the Judah and Tamar story in ways that will help you understand Christ and understand the importance of that story. And you'll need it if you're going to understand a lot of other things that happen for the rest of the Old Testament. So you've got to get that Judah and Tamar section in as well. And then on the Patreon website, and I know not everyone can join that, I want you to know I don't make any money at all off the podcast, zero money, but it does take money to run the podcast. And I wish it didn't. I wish I didn't have to do fundraising. I wish I didn't have to do anything. I would be so much happier if I didn't. But we do have to have some money to make the podcast go. And the Patreon website is what makes the free parts possible. So I'm sorry that not everyone can be on there, but there would be no free parts. And most of what we do is for free. There would be no free parts if we didn't have some parts that raise money so that we can produce the podcast. And so we are grateful for those who would love to but can't join the Patreon website. It is like the cost of for going out. If you skip one or one and a half times of going out to eat fast food this month, you can join the Patreon website. But whatever works for you, those who can and support us, we're grateful for that. We are going to go through kind of in depth the nuts and bolts of what life was like in Egypt. I show a video of making bread and pictures from ancient Egyptian inscriptions and maps that I've made and so on. And we go through the history of Egypt and try and fit Joseph in there. And we also draw some lessons from the Joseph story and that special Patreon lesson. Go to the collections, click on the collections link at the top, and then you'll find these special lessons. They're not things you download. They're not like paper things. It's videos that I've put together. So we're going to have a great week. Let's jump in and do this as we go through the Joseph story. As we start talking about the Joseph story, which is such a rich story, I'm going to start it here in Egypt. I'm in Egypt near our excavation site, and we'll see a little bit of kind of where that is in a little while. But I wanted to show people some of the things that might make this story be more real for them, because after all, this is about the scriptures being real. Now, I know that more than half of our audience only listens, and I pretty much just listen to my podcast audio. I don't have time to get on YouTube and watch. And so I know many of you won't be able to see this, and that's fine. I'll try to describe it as well. And you may want to just take 5 or 10 minutes when you get home from exercising or the car ride or something to just watch the first part of the YouTube video of this. We'll also put in some pictures that I've taken over the years, and that will help you as well. Then for our Patreon class, I'm going to have lots of visuals. We're going to go through some of the detailed history of just a little bit here, and then we'll do detailed history and pictures of Egyptian elements of this and so on. So we'll talk about all sorts of things. We'll have maps and whatnot in our class. We'll do a little bit of that here, but a lot more of maps in the class. So
we excavate in an area called the Fayum. It is a depression that is south and west of Cairo. It was a lake at one point, an inland lake, much like Lake Bonneville. It was an inland, it wasn't a lake, it was a sea. And you'll find out in the desert, coral, remains of coral and so on. It was a huge inland sea that has since been drained out in many ways. And it's kind of, there is a salt lake here. It's not as big as the Great Salt Lake, but there is a very large salt lake that is left over. And I just want to show you, before I start to walk back, some of the areas around here. It is a huge and incredibly fertile region. Now, part of the reason I'm talking about this is because of this canal that I'm walking along here that they've recently dredged. You can see the big pile of mud that's become a bank for it as they were recently dredging it. They have to do that every now and then. In any case, this is a really, really fertile area, and this canal is called the Bar Yusuf, or in other words, the Canal of Joseph, based on the idea that Joseph built it. I don't think he really did, but we'll talk more about that in the Patreon and just lightly here. I don't think he really did, but there is a chance, but that's the idea. You may not know that Muslims believe in the Bible and the stories of the Bible. They don't believe that Jesus is the Son of God, but they believe he was a great prophet. But of course, for them, Muhammad is the great prophet. But they believe in the Bible, and the stories of Joseph mean something to them. So Bar Yusuf, the Canal of Joseph, their belief is that he built this canal to make this area so fertile as part of that story that we get of his preparing the land for the years of famine. Well, this canal certainly does help make this area fertile. There are springs here in the Fayum, but this is built off of in ancient times, this was built off of the Nile so that you get lots of water coming to make this very, very fertile. And so you'll get all these fields of wheat all over here. So I'm here, this is February 2nd, actually. So happy Groundhog Day, but February 2nd. So the wheat is still young. We will put in pictures from the wheat harvest in these fields right over here. We're also, they grow a lot of cabbage here. You can see lines of cabbage out there. a little bit. Huge cabbage. They grow all sorts of things. We're going to go past some broccoli fields in just a minute. That's a new crop that they've just planted on land that we had to negotiate whether it would stay part of the archaeological concession or not. And it wasn't part of our concession already, and we didn't find any remains there. So it became cabbage or broccoli. Sorry, I said cabbage, broccoli fields. In any case, this area is incredibly fertile, and that's part of what is worth thinking about, that this may have been part of the biblical story, this area. So let me talk just a little bit about the Fayum. We're going to talk in the lesson about the Patreon lesson. And by the way, our Patreon channel, we try and put all sorts of stuff on there. We've got the links from Michel Gâteau with the art symbolism lessons, and art and symbolism is important to help us understand. Well, really understanding symbolism is an important part of understanding the Bible. But in any case, we also have all these lessons and all sorts of other material on there. You can even find stuff for mental health and whatnot. We try and have all sorts of edifying educational content on our Patreon channel. So we'll talk about the Hyksos there and the political situation a little bit. But I wanted to talk a little bit about this Fayum area and the geographic situation. So Egypt, and just the history of Egypt in general. Egypt, by the way, what we're seeing right here and up here along these ditches, all along here, these are ditches they're irrigating today. So they even in ancient times today, they have modern pumps, of course, but in ancient times they had this kind of lever system that would help them bring water from the canals into the ditches so that they could irrigate. And they did in a lot of areas. It was just by flooding, but in areas like this, they also moved the water. These are what are called bulrushes. So when we get to the Exodus story, and well, in the King James translation, it's translated as bulrushes. When we get to the Exodus story, and it says he was left in the flags, or the bulrushes, the little ark that had the baby Moses in it, what I'm going past right now is exactly what you should picture. In any case, the history of Egypt is such that we have the really ancient times. We call that pre-dynastic. Here's a beautiful field of wheat. So the pre-dynastic period is when Egypt is just coming together. Then you get into a period of strong centralization that we call the Old Kingdom. That's an Egyptological term. We just made that up as Egyptologists, but it's a handy one. The Old Kingdom. That goes for a long time and is before the days of Abraham. So this is the days of the Great Pyramid or the Great Pyramids. So for example, the pyramid I excavate was built by Snefru. He built three other pyramids. He's the first king of the fourth dynasty. Three other huge pyramids. Mine was his smallest by far. Well, it's not mine, it's the Egyptians, but the one I excavate. Then his son Khufu built the Great Pyramid. His son, Khufu's son, Snefru's grandson, Khafre built the next largest pyramid and also the Sphinx, and then his son, so Snefru's great-grandson, Menkaure, built the last pyramid there at Giza. And anyway, that's the Old Kingdom era. That's pre-Abraham. Very, very old part of history. So my pyramid was probably built around 2650 BC, so it's about 4,650 years old, roughly. So just to give you an idea, then we have the centralized government falling apart for a little while. We call that the first intermediate period, probably some periods of issues with the Nile flooding and some low agricultural or economic years. And then we get what is known as the Middle Kingdom. The Middle Kingdom roughly coincides with Abraham's life. Abraham lived about 200 years, according to the numbers we have in the Bible now. Those numbers may not be completely accurate, but I think they convey accurately that he lived for a very long time. And if those numbers are accurate, then he is roughly contemporary with the Middle Kingdom of Egypt. So here we're coming up on some of the broccoli fields, as well as some more wheat. In any case, and you can see that they have cabbage in here as well. Anyway, so The The Middle Kingdom coincides roughly with Abraham's life. Abraham, well, the Middle Kingdom was the shortest lived of the three major centralized periods of Egyptian history, which we called Old Kingdom, Middle Kingdom, and New Kingdom. Moses is alive during the New Kingdom. In any case, the Middle Kingdom, just towards the end of it, the centralized government starts to fragment, they fall apart a little bit, and you get Egypt having, it fragments, and you get lots of little areas of Egypt where different people call themselves king of Egypt, sometimes even king of all Egypt, while it's clear they're king of only a small part of Egypt. I don't know exactly how Abraham fits into that chronology, but he probably makes his visit just to Egypt, just as it's starting to fragment. Beautiful fields of broccoli, right? This is a really fertile area. And there you can see all the fields of wheat for about as far as the eye can see. That's just a lot of beautiful wheat that would feed a lot of people. In any case, Abraham may have visited Egypt. And the pharaoh he visits may not have been a pharaoh of all of Egypt, but just of a small part of Egypt. And we'll go into that more in depth in our Patreon lesson. But that's probably Abraham's life. I'm not completely sure. It's hard to figure out this chronology exactly. Well, it is during the Middle Kingdom that they start to go through what we would call reclaiming this land. This area was not very inhabited. There was certainly a strong presence in part of it for the Old Kingdom. That's why there's a pyramid built here. There's a cemetery near our pyramid. The work I'm doing here is part of our figuring out that there was more going on in the Fayum during the Old Kingdom than we had often thought of. And so I'm a part of that conversation Egyptologically. But in any case, there was something going on here in the Old Kingdom, but they really do a lot of work here in the Middle Kingdom, and it starts to become a land that is associated with the pharaohs. There are a lot of crocodiles here. The crocodile becomes strongly associated with the pharaoh during that time period, which is interesting in terms of facsimile one. But in any case, this area becomes very important and very fertile. Now, Joseph may have been part of the very, very, very tail end of the Middle Kingdom, or more likely, right in the middle of what we call the Second Intermediate Period. And this is what the Patreon lesson will be on, where we go through this in detail. But just to say briefly here, and we will also go into other elements, Egyptological elements of the Joseph story, including talking about prisons and what we know of them and how that fits into the story and so on, so that it will make a lot more sense to you. The story will make more sense to you. In any case, very briefly, the Joseph story probably includes an element of Joseph helping this foreign group that will rule Egypt, called the Hyksos, and what we call the Second Intermediate Period Egyptologically. They will take over and rule Egypt. And in my opinion, that's most likely the setting for the Joseph story. And he is probably part of what helps him become the rulers of the land. And so, as I said, we'll go through that with the maps and everything else on the Patreon website. But this area, the Fayum, may have been part of that. And so there is a small chance that Bar Yusuf really is the canal of Joseph. It's unlikely, but maybe, because this very fertile land could be a real part of preparing for the years of famine and that we read about in the biblical story. So as we get closer, we're coming right here to the end of, and these fields are 1 year old, by the way. Last year, well, 2 years ago is when I was working in this area. In fact, we went into some areas right up there that are not part of my excavation site. So that our concession, I'll show you. I'm going to walk along the boundary of that in just a minute. But right up in here, they'd heard there were some little tomb things that had been found, and they wanted me to go and investigate it. And so we had to take a four-wheel drive up into the mountain up there, and we did find a tunnel where I literally had to get a rope and lower it down on a Well, I lowered a flashlight down first to make sure things were all right down there. And then went down, a student and I, Jenna Norris, she went down first. She really wanted to, so we let her go down. She's adventurous and fantastic, doing her graduate work at Berkeley right now. In any case, we had to climb down on a rope and check it out. It certainly were some plundered and empty elements of a tomb there, but nothing that would prevent them from doing archaeological work down here. That was all up in the hillside. In any case, at that point, this was just desert area, but they've now been able to, and it's a friend of mine who works for us sometimes hauling sand on the excavation. He owns this land, or at least farms this land. I don't know if he owns it. And he's planted this big broccoli field. I was talking to him just a few minutes ago as he drove past on his motorcycle. So, but the whole part of the reason I'm showing you that is as we get here to the edge of the excavation site, you can see, so we call it a desert, and it is, and there is sand, and really Egypt is kind of the edge of the Sahara, but there is sand in this area. Lots of Egypt has nothing but sand, but where we're at, there's sand, but there's also a lot of dirt on top. It's a dusting. We get filthy just walking around and moving things because it's a powdery dust. And so what it means is that if you can get water to it, the crops will grow. Now, that's not the case here, but along the Nile Valley, that's partially because for thousands of years, every year it flooded and deposited this beautiful, rich alluvial silt that was fantastic, fertilized great ground with nutrients, new dirt with great nutrients deposited every year. But the fact of the matter is that here in Egypt, if you can get water to it, it will grow. So what I'm showing you, I'm walking up the little road that is the border between the agricultural land and our concession. There's a little building over there you can see. That's a guard tower that we built before I was part of the dig, but where they can kind of keep watch over. And there's another one right here where they can keep watch over the archaeological site and make sure no one's doing anything there. But I want to show you right here, you can see the line where you've got agriculture and then it ends and it's desert. And whoever built that canal, Joseph or whomever, and Joseph certainly did something to help with the agriculture. If you're going to have really good years with lots of water, you can't just say, okay, get more out of the same bit of land. You've got to expand the land you're farming on. And so they must have done some kind of what we call reclamation, some kind of expanding how far out they could get the water while they had an abundance so that they would have great yields of harvest for a time period. So they must have done something like what has happened here. Oh, and I can see now it's actually created a drip system. Look at that. It's got water that comes out through these little plastic lines. I don't think they did that in ancient times, but they got water by means of a canal like this, whether it be in the Fayum or in the Nile Valley, and it's probably both. And they expanded the land so that there was less of this desert and more of this fertile land. And that's what makes the years of plenty in Egypt work so well, so that they can get through the famine and the people around them can get through the famine. Now, that is a lot of technical explanation, but hopefully it helps the scriptures become more real to you, both by seeing it and thinking through what Joseph had to do in his historical setting. So we'll do more of the historical setting and the symbolism and what the art in Egypt can tell us about this period and so on. We'll do more of that in the podcast, but for everyone, I hope that you're thinking through really what is it like for Joseph in Egypt? What is this harvest like? What is the famine like? When you can't get water out to this land, it ends up looking like this land. And that's what they're going to have to deal with everywhere as that famine happens. So I'm now going to take my walk back over to the site and get back to work. They're over there working without me, and I need to be part of the tomb we're working on, but I hope this was helpful for you. All right, I hope that was useful for you to picture that. And now please join my wife and I as we walk along the Nile River
and talk about the Joseph story. And I think this will help you explore it. And then make sure you tune in after that for the next section and for information about the Palm Sunday walk.
Welcome to The Scriptures Are Real. Here we are in Egypt today, walking along here, along the Nile. You can see the Nile right to the side of us. We'll continue to kind of see the Nile as we walk. And we're here enjoying Egypt, and we thought it would be a great location to be able to talk about the story of Joseph.
This is one of the best stories in the world. Like, this is fantastic literature. Even if it weren't true, it is true, but fantastic literature. And part of the reason for that is because of the real human element and real human drama in this, combined with one of the great miracles of God. It's just amazing. And since this is The Scriptures Are Real, I thought maybe we could start out talking about some real elements, right? The story starts out, we'll do a separate segment on the Judah and Tamar part of this. So I want to make sure we help our readers or our audience understand that. But we're going to do a separate segment on that. But the story starts out with Joseph and his brothers in the conflict with his brothers, right? And this is just a family. I've said so many times, people are probably tired of me saying it, but one of the great things about reading the Bible, especially Genesis, is that we see some of the greatest people still had difficult family situations.
Yeah.
Right? So, I don't know if you have thoughts about Joseph and the difficulties with his brothers. I know you and I both get really tired of our kids asking about who's the favorite, or someone does something, oh, see, they're the favorite. I don't know.
Absolutely. No. And once you're a parent, at least I think in most cases, you understand you just love your children. Your heart is able to expand. And you may have like slightly different relationships or things that are involved, but it's not about favorites. It's about, I don't know, relationships. And then those can be even different with one child at one point in life versus another point in life.
And yet we have this complication in the Joseph story, and I agree with you 100%, but in the Joseph story, you have the added dynamic of Rachel was the woman that Jacob fell in love with. She wasn't able to have children for so long. When she finally does have children, it's Joseph. This is the child Jacob had been dreaming about when he started working 7 years to be with Rachel, right? And so that does seem to affect things a little bit, at least in terms of birthright. And I think that's the issue that we often miss here, is that it talks about Joseph being favored. Does that mean Jacob loved Joseph more? I don't think so. Does it mean he treated Joseph nicer? I don't think so. But he's clearly chosen him as the birthright child. And a lot of people go through all sorts of things like, okay, well, the birthright child is supposed to be the oldest son. Now, I'm going to make a full admission, I'm the second oldest son in my family, so I will highlight this part. But in Genesis and Exodus, at no point ever is the oldest son the birthright son. That just never happens. God seems to be making the point, we're going to choose the son that this should go to, who will do what he should do best, and we'll talk about what he should do in a second. The birthright is something that we often misunderstand. And it's because of our human nature. And I think even though culturally it was more normal for them, I think they didn't think of it correctly most of the time either. We, because the world influences us, tend to think of any kind of leadership position as an element of prestige and power, that it's about the person and their prestige and power. That's not how God thinks of it. And we'll have this discussion again a little bit next week, because we'll be talking about the blessings to the tribes. But the way God thinks of this is you have leadership as a call to serve. It's not about the person. It's about them representing God to people and serving them the way they should. Right?
Right. And that's why the double portion is given, is for a greater ability to serve and take care of the family.
All right, so we decided that in Egypt, they honk every when you're driving to let you know that you're there.
Well, we didn't decide that.
Well, we decided that we would come down here to get away from it a little bit. So it won't be too loud.
So anyway, there's something going on here, but anyway. So we were talking about the birthright. And with the birthright, the idea is that you serve other people. And so in ancient times, the birthright child would be given a double portion because they were supposed to take care of family members. When a family member died, they take care of the family. If someone had problems with their crops or whatever, and we'll talk more about the specifics of it when we get to the Law of Moses and no more specifics, but we know at this time and all times, the birthright child was supposed to take care of the family on behalf of the parents, basically to take that parent's role and take care of the family. So that's the point of the birthright. And Joseph has clearly been chosen as the birthright son. And we sometimes get into all sorts of things like, okay, Reuben was supposed to be the birthright son because he was supposed to be the birthright son because he was oldest, but because of his sins with his father's concubine, he couldn't, and then it was supposed to be others, and they had sins, and so on, so it fell to Joseph. Maybe that's true. We actually have no idea. We're making that up based on the story, and it makes some sense for the story and our assumption that it should go to the oldest child, which is typical, but it's also very possible that Jacob just said, this is the oldest son of the wife I intended to marry, therefore he's the birthright child. For whatever reason, he just decides, Joseph is clearly being given the treatment of the birthright child. He's being given clothing that designates he's the birthright child. We don't know if it's really many colors or long sleeve or something, but clothing that designates it, he's being treated differently in a number of different ways. And this really bothers his siblings.
Yeah.
Maybe Jacob is not performing this ideally. Maybe he is. I think he's just trying to figure it out. Maybe Joseph,
And like you've already said, like the stories in the Bible and stories in all scriptures show messy families, not perfect people, but how lives were and the mistakes even they made, whether that's a mistake or not, you know, it's hard to say, like you're saying, it might have been a cultural thing. It could have been lots of things, but
And I can certainly look in our family lots of times when I was trying to do my best, and in hindsight, I can think, maybe if I'd done that a little differently, this would have happened a little bit better, right? We can all see that.
Yeah.
Sorry, in the end, you were saying?
I mean, I don't need to say it. Go ahead.
Okay. So, and there's a part of me that wants to say, okay, Joseph, when he's coming out and saying, hey, everyone, I dreamed a dream that says I'm going to be in charge, that maybe that's not wise. And yet at the same time, I don't know that he wasn't inspired to do that.
Right.
And I don't know that Jacob wasn't inspired to be being clear he's the birthright child and I need to teach him certain things and do certain things differently, right? We just don't know.
Well, and it seems with the story and the storyline, how things went, he was inspired, not in a way that removes all complications,
right?
But that gives us the story that the Lord seems to maybe have intended to have happen.
Yeah, there's no doubt this works out the way God wanted it to work out. Does that mean everyone had perfect motives all along? No. Clearly, when they're selling Joseph into slavery, they don't have perfect motives. There are a lot of elements of this story that are difficult and people aren't doing well, right? His brothers struggle with the way that Joseph is treated. There's some jealousy there. Reuben, I think, sometimes doesn't get the credit that he deserves. I want everyone, and we want to be clear about this. I try and say this often, and I haven't as much lately because we've got all these segments instead of just one long episode. We want you to go back and read the scriptures. I do fear that we become a replacement for scripture reading. We don't want that. We want to assist and get you back into it. So I'm going to encourage you to go back in and read the story, and you'll see, if you read carefully, that Reuben did not want Joseph to be sold into slavery. It almost seems like, I read the story this way, but I can't say for sure, that he's trying to talk them into throwing him in the pit with the intent to come back and rescue him later. Mm-hmm. And then he comes back and finds they've sold him. With Judah, I'm not even 100% sure because that Judah was all terrible about this. It may be that some of the brothers were saying, let's kill him. And Judah's solution is, oh, let's sell him so at least we don't kill him. In the end, I don't know. But they didn't have pure motives. That's for sure. And Joseph gets sold. And we get this little insight. We'll encounter it in the reading for next week, but it really applies to this week, so let's talk about it. This little insight when the brothers come down and meet Joseph in Egypt. And they and Joseph is playing a little game with them that we can talk about next week, but they see things aren't going well for them. And the first thing they say is, this is happening because of what we did to Joseph. And they also say, didn't we see? Well, let me find it and read it, because it's really quite touching. They don't understand that Joseph, or they don't know Joseph can understand them. They said one to another, we are verily guilty concerning our brother in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore is this distress come upon us. So this is the little insight we have to the anguish of Joseph's soul. Like, can you imagine? Really? Like, I understand you were upset, you threw me in a pit. You act like you're going to sell me, but really you're selling me? Don't do this, brothers. How can you do this to me? That anguish of soul. Yeah, help me. Don't. You're doing it to me. Rather, you should be helping me. Please. And it's haunted them ever since.
Well, and I'm sure that pleading started from being thrown in the pit.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure you're right. But then I think it became much more real as he was being sold into slavery. And it's haunted them ever since. Every bad thing that happens to them, they think, oh, this is because of this. You will see from Judah's response later, they feel terrible about what it did to their father. It is the next verse, so, and I know this is next week's reading, but it so applies, these verses so apply to this one. Reuben answered them, saying, spake I not unto you, saying, do not sin against the child, and you would not hear. Therefore, behold, his blood, also his blood is required. So Reuben was sticking up for Joseph, didn't want this to happen, right? But it's crazy drama, and now Joseph is sold into slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't even imagine that. And this story is so interesting because at every turn, it seems like Joseph is punished for obedience.
Exactly.
Right? He's doing what he should, and this makes his brothers mad, so he's sold into slavery.
I've thought of that quite a lot, right? Like, he's this favored child, and he has this dream that is supposed to have him be ruler and have, you know, these great outcomes. And instead, he's thrown into a pit. You know, they're talking about, you know, letting him die. Then they sell him into slavery. Then he goes into Egypt, and he's in prison. Then he's able to be out, and it seems like things are going well again. And then while he's trying to do the right thing,
he resists Potiphar's wife.
Yep. And then he's thrown back into prison. And I, like you're saying, like, he's doing all the right things. And he is told that things are going to be different than this. And I think it's easy when we're in situations like this to feel like angry at God, or like, why has God left me?
Yeah.
And if Joseph had acted on those types of feelings, you know, he would have been left in despair in prison. Things wouldn't have turned out the way they had, because he had to continue to trust in God in order for the outcome to eventually come. If he would have given up on God, it would have been different.
Yeah.
Anyway, that, I didn't mean to interrupt what your thoughts were, but they're along a similar vein, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's exactly right. I mean, you think about, especially, you can see it throughout the whole story, but especially the part where he flees Potiphar's wife. So he has done exactly what God would want him to do, and that results in his being thrown in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He'd gotten to where things were better, and it results in his being thrown in prison. So it seems like, okay, I'm serving God. God's blessing me. At least things are pretty good here in this household.
For a short time.
Yeah, for a short time. And in the Patreon episode, we'll go through some of the details and what this would have looked like, and the details of prison and what this would have looked like. But for a short time, it goes well. And then because he's obedient, now he's in prison, which is, just to be clear on this, what we'll talk about more. I mean, prisons are labor camps, all right? So it's not just sit around. And you're right. Not only, it's hard when you feel like you're doing everything right and things fall apart and you ask yourself, God, why did this happen? I think it's even harder when it's happened because you were doing everything that was right. You know, I know people who because they donated money to the church in support of certain political things happening in California, they lost their job when the names were released that were public of it, right? So they did what was right and lost their job and never did get it back, actually. Ended up with having to take early retirement and so on, right? It's really hard when you feel like you're being punished for it. But as you said,
yeah,
that is in some ways when you deepen your faith in God.
It's that Abrahamic sacrifice. That's that test that we're all supposed to go through. And you see it throughout Scripture, not just with Joseph of Egypt, Joseph Smith, and again you see this kind of example. But when it happens to us personally, then we think somehow it should be different. Yeah. Somehow, if I'm doing these things, then this should be the immediate outcome, which is, you know, prosperity of some sort, not always financial, but some, like, life is going well. Things are coming together for us. Doors are opening for us because we're doing the right thing, which is very tempting and it seems right. And in an eternal perspective, as thinking celestial, it is the truth and what will happen. But the question is do we fall apart and do we turn away? You know, where else do we go? Well, sometimes it's going towards thinking, well, if I've done these things and it's not turning out, then maybe this isn't the right church. Or maybe, you know, there's something else that will give me more happiness. And then we fail our test.
Yeah.
Fail that moment of being tried and staying true.
Good. And let's be clear, when we talk about a test, it's not a, like, oh, God doesn't know. And it's not even God needs us to know. It's a, we become something different, right? So when you say
fail a
test, and it's not that once you failed, you can't have Christ change that, you become something different again, right? We always have a second chance. There's no only one test. But he puts us in these situations, and if we respond by turning to him, we become more like him.
Mm-hmm.
And if we respond by turning away from him, then we become less like him.
Yeah.
And so it's these crucibles. And I know we've both felt it. We both know that at a time when we felt like we were really consecrating ourselves to God, I just started serving as a bishop. We had chances to do this or that, and we felt like, we'll do whatever God wants. And it took some while to figure out what God wanted, but we did that. We were doing everything we could in all sorts of ways, including having started this podcast and all sorts of other things, just fully giving our lives to God. And right then is when the hardest things that have ever happened to our family happened.
Yeah.
And it was easy to say, why now?
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're more dedicated than we've ever been in our lives. Why would the terrible things happen now? Instead, and I can't say that, you know, it was this way every second for me. It probably was for you because you're always better than me, but...
Probably. I don't know what you're going to say.
I'm not saying that there were no times where I didn't have some questions. So, for example, and I think I've shared this on the podcast before, but I can remember we took our daughter, who was just struggling so much, and we took her to a Vocal Point concert. That's an a cappella group at BYU. And she liked them and just wanted her to have a moment of happiness. And one of the people we know came out and sang what has been my favorite hymn, which is Nearer My God to Thee. And he gets that part where it says, even though it be a cross that raises me. And I felt like I was drawing closer to God through this experience, through a cross, but the cross was my daughter suffering.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem fair, and that doesn't seem right. And for about a day and a half, I hated that song. And I struggled with the idea, like, wait, can this be right that I draw closer to God because of my daughter suffering? Is that fair to her? And I had to work that out because it wasn't really, you know, I won't get into all of that, but I had to work that out with God, but it could have easily turned away from God instead of turning to God. And that's been the case all throughout. I drew closer during that experience. I don't know about you. I think I know the answer, but I'll let you speak for myself. But I know for me, I drew closer to God because of that trial than I've ever been. And I sometimes I think, okay, I'm not as close now as I was then, but I know I'm different. I'm closer and better and more like God because of that experience of being forced to turn to him when I had leveled up in being close to God he gave me the terrible opportunity and wonderful opportunity to level up even more. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's happening for Joseph.
Yeah, I think you're right. That, you know, the life experiences that we have help us to be able to decide more fully that we want to, that is a choice, that we want to turn to God and trust Him. And making that choice gives the opportunity to move from being having like a more simple testimony to the other side of complexity, where that faith is deepened, the understanding and the access that we gain to the atonement is greater. But sometimes it feels, I guess maybe there's an awareness also that's added of how much further we have to go. And that's what can also add to a feeling of a little bit more distance, even though it might be closer.
One of the things I was going to say is there is an irony in that we often have something that pushes us away from God that then actually propels us towards God, including coming to earth, right? Or Adam and Eve in the fall and so on. And so those moments where we felt like, wait, God, you abandoned me, that's kind of a pushing away. But yet if we do it correctly, it propels us to God. And to me, that's one of the great stories in the Joseph story, or one of the great elements of the Joseph story. Joseph decides to turn to God through everything. He gives credit to God for the dreams and his ability to interpret dreams. He doesn't take credit for himself. He has complete faith in God that this is a gift and that he can interpret these dreams. And even when he's forgotten, he tells the butler to remind Pharaoh about him, or tell Pharaoh about him, and the butler forgets until the butler needs him. But through all of this, Joseph stays faithful to God. And it's a long time. This is years, and he still remains faithful to God. So what an incredible example.
Really, truly. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, those types of things where you can look at the story and see what we can personally learn from it, how we can grow from it, and understand how we can be better disciples of Jesus Christ. This is a powerful story to look at.
Amen. So what we'll do now is we're going to have a segment on the Judah and Tamar story, and we'll talk about how that teaches us about Joseph, but some other things, and it sets up some things we'll see in the reading for next week. And I'll also just touch on this topic just a little bit more when I can show you some things in the next segment. But before we do that, Julianne, I thought maybe I'd just tell a funny story that is from a Muslim tradition about Joseph, because we like to make the scriptures real. And I doubt it's true, but it's a long-standing tradition. It helps me at least start to think about the realities of things. So in this story, and we have to remember who Joseph's parents are, right? So you've got great-grandma Sarah, so beautiful, everyone wants to marry her. Great-grandma Rebecca, so beautiful, everyone wants to marry her. Grandma Rebecca. And then mom, Rachel, doesn't say a lot about her beauty, but dad falls in love with her immediately, right?
Yeah, right.
Joseph, according to this legend, is just one hunk of a guy. Like, he is to die for when you see how beautiful he is. So in this story, Potiphar's wife, she falls for Joseph, right? She's just dying for Joseph. And word gets out, and her Egyptian friends are making fun of her for falling for this Hebrew. And so she makes this plan to show them how they don't know what they're talking about. So she invites them all over to her house for a snack. And the snack is going to be some fruit that you have to cut. And she makes sure that they sharpen the knives as sharp as they can. And she gives them all the fruit to cut and says, okay, start to cut your fruit, and arranges to have Joseph come in right at that moment. And in the story, they all are so distracted with how handsome Joseph is that they all slice their hands. And that's when they realize that they won't blame her for falling in love with Joseph. I think it's a silly story,
It's a fun story.
It is a fun story. I mean, it's a silly fun story. But the point is that it's worth thinking through, like, what does this look like? How uncomfortable is this for Joseph? What is he doing? What is she doing? How is he praying, God, I've got this problem with this girl. What do I do about it? What steps do I take? And so on, right? I mean, I don't know that we need to think through all the details of that, but I hope we can think through it enough to realize how real Joseph is, how real the people around him are. We all have to deal with some kind of drama with the people in our lives all around us, whether it be people we have to work with, people in our ward or whatever. God gives us this life as a lab. He puts us around imperfect people because that's what we need to learn how to be Christ-like, and we're the imperfect people for the people around us to teach them how to be Christ-like as they deal with us. You know that well. But anyway, and so you may not have Potiphar's wife, but you've got someone. Everybody listening to this has someone that is part of their lab that you just keep going to God like, I don't know how to deal with this situation. I don't know what to do. And it may go terribly before it goes better, as it did for Joseph. It went terribly. He did everything he could the best way he could, and it went terribly. Mm-hmm. And yet God made that work out well. I cannot tell you how many times in our life we've had things where I thought God put me in this situation so this would happen, and I was working so hard to make that happen. I'd been inspired to go into that situation, or you'd been inspired, or we'd been inspired together to go into that situation, mm-hmm. and then it turned out so not how we thought. But in hindsight, years later, you can see, oh, well, it was really, he put me in this situation not to do this, but so that this could happen, it turned me here, and then this could happen.
Right.
Right. Which is what happens with the Joseph story. And that's one of the things we have to have faith in as well. As this story becomes real for us, we have to have faith that the Lord knows what he's doing, and we often misunderstand what he's doing, and we'll just be patient and wait on the timing of the Lord.
We jump with our judgment to an outcome, to an end result that we think, well, if he's sending us here, this is what it means. And we can get really kind of stuck if we can't let go of realizing that that was our interpretation of how, you know, why we're receiving that particular prompting or direction. It was for a certain outcome, but to keep trusting in the Lord and keep making the steps as we are guided to see what the Lord actually had in mind versus our interpretation.
Yeah. And remember, it's the process. This is about, as President Oaks has taught us, it's a gospel of becoming. It's about what we're becoming. So it's the process, not the outcomes. And you've said mm-hmm. this better and more times than I. It's the process, not the outcomes. We need to remember God is focused on the process. Only one outcome, he's the final outcome, making us godlike. That's what he's really working towards. So everything else is the process towards that. And we want all these little outcomes along the way where God's happy for us to go through the process.
Well said.
All right. That was kind of a funny way to record that. That was an adventure. Now we're back in my studio or my office, and I want to talk to you about Judah and Tamar. You really have to understand this to understand so many things about this story and the rest of the Bible. But I also want to tell you about the Palm Sunday Walk. We hope that if you're anywhere near the Orem, Utah or Linden, Utah area, that you'll be able to join us. It's a fantastic way of being able to celebrate and kick off the Holy Week and really focus on Christ. We do this long walk that ends at the Linden Temple, which will be just very close to being dedicated. The open house will be going on. So this is on Palm Sunday, which is March 29th, Sunday, March 29th. And you can join us at 325 Canal Drive in Linden, Lindon, 325 Canal Drive in Linden, Utah. All right. It's going to be at 3:30 p.m. and it will take about an hour. So March 29th, 3:30 p.m. It's at 325 Canal Drive in Linden, Utah. That's going to be at a church. You can park there, and then we'll walk along the Murdoch Canal Trail. I'll give us a little bit of a send-off and then do some teaching when we get there at the temple. That's where Christ's Palm Sunday original event ended. It was at a temple, so we're ending at a temple. And we hope that you'll join us.
we'll have some palm fronds there, but if you can you bring any kind of greener you want, or draw, or bring nothing at all, or you can just like bring a paper palm or something like that, anything that works for you. We'd love to have you join us and be part of worshiping Christ as we celebrate the Palm Sunday walk. So thank you. And now let's jump in and talk about Judah and Tamar and symbolism of Christ in that story. In this section, we're going to talk about Genesis 38, the story of Judah and Tamar, a story that seems out of place and many people will be tempted to just skip, but I feel like we need to cover it because it will help us understand some things that happen in next week's reading in the Joseph story and a number of things that happen in the Bible, including in the Ruth story. So we need to set some things up if we're going to really understand this. It is an odd story and yet an important one. So its placement is odd above all things. It's just you get the Joseph story started in chapter 37 and it continues in chapter 39, but chapter 38 is this weird interruption with this story. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, Judah's having problems kind of story. And yet that must be intentional. It's not we forgot this, let's stick it in right here. I believe that the authors did this intentionally, and Judah will, in this case, serve as a foil for Joseph. He will also serve as a foil for his future self, and we'll talk about that for next week's reading. But in this case, he's serving as a foil for Joseph. Because right as we get to this part in the Joseph story, Joseph has just come in. He's been sold by Judah and his other brothers to the Midianites, or it changes whether it's Ishmaelites or Midianites, depending on where in the chapter you're reading. But anyway, so maybe it's immediately to one group and then they sell him to another group, or maybe they just got the name wrong at some point. I don't know. But in any case, he is sold then to Potiphar, who is an officer in Pharaoh's court and captain of the guard. We have that at the very end of chapter 37. The Hebrew word that we translate there as officer is a saris. He's a eunuch. A eunuch is a castrated male. So this is worth knowing. There you have lots of eunuchs in lots of parts of the ancient world that serve in trusted positions because, one, they're not going to have offspring. And so they're not going to be working to try and make things work well for their family or so on like that. They have to be more of a loyal to the king. They also can be trusted around the king's harem, his wives, because they're not going to do anything with them. Now, this is part of the story that may help us understand why his wife is so interested in Joseph. But really, it kind of sets up what will happen in the Joseph story, which is where Joseph proves amazingly faithful. He will not be immoral with Potiphar's wife, given whatever comes his way, whatever pressure comes his way. Whereas Judah, that's not going to be the case with Judah. But we need to understand a little bit more as we get into the Judah story. And what we need to understand is what is called the levirate law of marriage, coming from an Akkadian word, levir, which means the husband's brother, basically, brother-in-law, we could say. So here is the issue, and this is going to seem like a weird thing to a lot of people, and if you think about your own family life, it's going to seem weird. We need to take off the glasses of modernity and your own life and put on the lenses of their lives. And in their lives, the important thing is to take care of people who can't take care of themselves in a very different cultural and physical world. So one of the most vulnerable people is a young widow. A young widow, because when you get married, you move away from your family and you move in with your husband's family and you become part of that husband's family. You know, if you're a young widow, you either don't have children or you have children that are too young to help you support yourself. And so you need someone to help support you, both in terms of, for most people, supporting yourself involves a certain physicality that was difficult for a single woman to pull off. It also, in their culture, representation in society didn't work as well for a woman with no male to represent her. Usually you have your father to represent you or your husband to represent you. In this case, she has neither. If you're someone whose husband has just died, you've moved away from home and you're not really technically part of your father's household anymore, you are part of your husband's father's household in a way, but because you were married and your husband was married, you've started your own household. So you're not really quite part of their household. And that's a really terrible place to be. And especially if you're not going to have someone to care for you when you're older. This is something we have to think about. There's no Social Security, there's no 401k plans, and there's no pension plans and so on. When you're older and you can't take care of yourself in terms of all of that physicality, the manual labor that you need to go through to support yourself, it typically what you do is you rely on your children. You take care of your children when they're young, they take care of you when you're older. That's the way it works. But if you don't have children to take care of you, then you're in trouble. What is going to happen to you when you're older? You're in a terrible position. And so being widowed without children, or especially without a male child, because of course your daughters will be part of a different household when they get married. So this is a terrible situation. So the Leverett Law of Marriage means that when you, if you are a woman who is married and your husband dies, that your husband's family is responsible for taking care of you. It's really whoever has the birthright. And so in some cases, that will be the father-in-law. In some cases, it will be the brother-in-law. If the father-in-law has died or has already delegated this to his oldest son, or whichever son becomes the birthright, which is typically the oldest son. So they are supposed to take care of you. This is part of why receiving birthright blessings is so important. You're given a double inheritance. Your job is to use that inheritance to take care of people that need to be taken care of. So you're supposed to help. Let's say that you are the brother-in-law. Your brother has died. He has a young widow. If he has a young widow that has a child, that has a son, then your job is to take care of them until that son is old enough to inherit his father's land and goods and provide for the family. If there is no son, then you provide for the family and you provide a son. That's really what this is about. So you have to take care of those people and you provide a son, which is technically not your son. So if you are the brother-in-law, your brother dies, and then if you're the birthright brother-in-law, it is your job to take care of that widow, your sister-in-law, your brother's wife. And in a way, she is technically your wife, or really more technically, you are your brother in terms of being her husband. And you are responsible for making sure she can eat and take care of land, not lose land, but also for providing her with a male heir that will take care of her when she's older and that will inherit your brother's inheritance. So that's the job. And in a way, you are a husband, and that's what you're doing. Now we get to the story of Tamar. Judah has a son, and she marries Tamar, and Tamar dies, right? So that's the problem. Now, what is supposed to happen with Tamar? Well, what's supposed to happen is that Judah or his sons, and typically in terms of providing an heir, it will be the younger sons that will take on that responsibility. Although Judah is certainly still the one who has most of the resources and is taking care of people. So it will be in some ways his responsibility to make sure she's not starving, but it's going to be his son's responsibility to be the Leverett husband for Tamar. So what happens is his son dies. And so he tells one of his sons that it's time for him to go and provide an heir or impregnate his Leverett sister-in-law or Leverett wife, right? And the problem is, so this is Onan. And the problem is that Onan is willing to go through the pleasurable part of that act, but does not want to take on the obligations of that act. Remember, this son will not be considered his. And so the inheritance is going to go to the son. And in a way, if Tamar never has a son, then Onan's children get more inheritance, right? That's part of what's at play here. And so he is willing to go through part of that act, but not the obligation part. and as a result, he dies. And so now they've got another son that is a little bit young for taking on this responsibility. So Judah says, let's not have him do that, but he's doing it because he's like, wow, I've already had two sons that have died when they're involved with Tamar. Not sure I want to do that anymore. But after a while, Judah's wife dies, and he is out and about one day, and Tamar hears about it. And by now, she thinks either Judah or his remaining son should have given me a child by now. That's their obligation. That's what they're supposed to do. She is, in a way, married to whichever one is going to come into her to help her have a child. So this is something that she realizes that Judah has decided he's just going to skip out on. He's not going to be part of that responsibility. He's not going to send another son in. He's not going to take care of it himself. So she takes matters into her own hands. And she dresses as a harlot and convinces Judah to come into her. So she must know something about Judah's character fairly well that she can get Judah to come into her. Now, this is worth stopping and thinking about. Technically, neither one of them are committing adultery. Judah has a responsibility to provide her with a child through himself or through one of his sons. So technically, he's not committing adultery. She knows that this is what's supposed to happen and that she should have a child either by Judah or his son. So she is not committing adultery. That's the technicality. But God is not so worried about the technicality as about the intent of our hearts. So this is one of those rare cases where two people are doing the same thing, and I think one is guilty and one is not. In my view, and I'm not the judge, and I'm glad to not be the judge, but in my view, Judah is guilty of adultery because that's his intent. Or not adultery, but fornication. His wife has died. In any case, immorality. He intends to sleep with someone he is not married to, whereas Tamar intends to sleep with someone she is really married to. And so in the same act, I think Tamar is innocent and Judah is not. In any case, Tamar is very clever. She makes sure that she gets a pledge from him so he doesn't have anything to pay her with. She says, okay, give me something and I'll keep that until you come to pay me. He does come to pay her later and she's not there because she's not really a harlot. So she's off back to her normal life. But then when he finds out she's pregnant in a fantastic act of hypocrisy, and I don't mean fantastic as in that it's a really good thing. I mean, it's fantastically terrible. In an amazing act of hypocrisy, Judah is ready to kill her for having played the harlot on his dead son. And she is able to produce his signets, the pledges that he gave her, and so that he knows suddenly, oh, I'm the father. She did what she was supposed to do in order to have an heir. She forced me or tricked me into honoring the obligation that I was supposed to honor. By the way, honoring this obligation is so important. And there is that pressure of, well, that will take away from my children's inheritance. It's so important that someone who is not willing to do that, it's the only punishment I'm aware of in the law of Moses that involves public shaming. If you are not willing to take upon yourself this levirate duty, you are publicly shamed for running from that obligation. That's how serious this is to be taken. And so Judah recognizes that Tamar has done what she should do and that he should not kill her. And then she goes on and has a child. Interestingly, this child's descendant will be David, which means also that this child's descendant will be Christ. And I don't think that's a coincidence. And in fact, David will also be a descendant of another levirate marriage. So he and Christ are descendants of two levirate marriages. I don't think that's a coincidence because remember, the point of a levirate marriage is to take care of someone who cannot take care of themselves and to make sure that people have the opportunity for seed, for heirs, for family going forward and so on. This is what Christ does. He provides for us what we cannot provide for ourselves. He takes care of us in the ways we cannot take care of ourselves. And he gives us the opportunity to have eternal increase in family for forever. So it's not a coincidence that David and Christ are descended from not one, but two levirate marriages, including this one here we're reading about with Judah and Tamar. It's not a coincidence. I believe it's intentional. It's part of the symbolism that helps us understand who Christ is. And so this story is worth understanding so that we can recognize that element of Christ, that when death robs us and death will rob us all, Christ can still provide and take care of us and bless us with a future. That's really what the levirate marriage is about. And Christ, the product of two important levirate marriages, and who knows, maybe more, but two important ones we have in the scriptures, that he fulfills that role. I think that's important and that's beautiful. But it's also important to recognize this in the story because, again, we have Judah who is intentionally or intending to be immoral. And the next thing we read is Joseph intending to be moral. And so he's a contrast with Joseph. This may also be a little bit of a turning point for Judah. Something is a turning point, and next time we'll discuss several different things that I think are part of being a turning point for Judah. But I think it's important for us to recognize whether this is the turning point or not, and it may be where he realizes, okay, I've been messing up. I need to straighten up. It certainly will see a contrast between the selfishness he demonstrates in this story and the unselfishness he will demonstrate in future stories. And so it's important to recognize how the literary intent of the author in helping us to see or to highlight the goodness of Joseph and the change in Judah. And as I said, the importance of knowing who Christ is and what he does for us. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. We hope that you'll help share the goodness from this in a number of ways. Please do like and download and share and comment and help people learn about this podcast so that they can get more out of the Old Testament. And please reach out to someone in person, whether in person or via text or however you can. Take something you've learned and uplift and edify them and study the gospel together or just bless people's lives with something you've learned today. This has been The Scriptures Are Real, a Beehive Broadcast production.